The first thing that went through my head was disbelief. Like, I wasn't sure if she was playing a joke. Like, it was just like, wait, what? Are you being serious? And I just kind of said, what, what? And then once I realized it was real, it was kind of like, the best way I can describe it is, you know, when you're at the tip top of a roller coaster, right before you take the big drop, you know, and your stomach is like sinking. That's exactly how it felt. Like, it was like, to me, it was like a emotional wave just washed over me. It was just like the weirdest, like, worry, fear, every emotion. I was just like, what did we do?
Welcome to the Dadwell Podcast. I'm your host, Antonio Garcia. Dadwell & Company is an independent media project at the intersection of creativity and fatherhood. The Dadwell Podcast features makers, artists, musicians, authors, filmmakers, and designers who are raising the creative bar while simultaneously raising small humans. Today I'm talking creativity and fatherhood with illustrator, muralist, and designer Jesse Hora. Jesse is co-founder of Make & Company, a small but mighty husband and wife creative studio specializing in branding, creative direction, graphic design, and mural design. He and designer Abigail Nguyen focus on making beautiful and insightful work for premium and authentic brands. If you've spent any time in a cool Chicago spot, there's a good chance you've enjoyed a Make & Co. mural. Jesse is dad to his 2.5-year-old daughter, and at the time of recording this episode was just weeks away from the birth of his son. I'm happy to report his baby boy entered the world on May 24th. In this episode, Jesse recounts how his father's custom paint shop and motorcycle restoration work proved to him art and craft could feed a family of 10. We talk about the supernatural power infants have to melt hearts, soften the toughest of men, and bring a strange family closer together. And we talk about why it took over 2 years for him to make the case to his wife that they were ready to launch their own studio. Jesse also shares how bi-monthly drinks with a few trusted dads might be all the parenting therapy any of us needs. Finally, we discuss how nothing should be out of bounds for fathers, especially pirouettes with pre-K ballerinas.
Well, we'll start with something that should be the most familiar to you in terms of being an expert in your own life with your origin story. If you wouldn't mind telling me about your dad or other father figures you had growing up.
Wow. We're jumping right into the deep end, huh? The basic treetops are, I grew up in Southwest Michigan, big family. We had 8 kids, 2 stepkids. Kind of grew up in the... not really rural. It was sort of like hugging right up against the lake. So it was like quaint towns. And then really quickly, it gets rural. The setting was sort of big farmhouse, 8 kids running around, a lot of time at the lake and in the dunes and that sort of stuff. And my dad actually ran his own business painting like show cars. If you're familiar with that, that's like a really big thing. And definitely was in like the 80s and 90s. Like, he put crazy paint jobs and flames. And then he kind of just built that up and was able to support a huge family of 10. The hard part was my mom. She had, it's kind of a hard story, but she had like a mental breakdown way early on, like right after my little sister was born. I was like 1 or 2 when it happened. So she sort of degressed pretty slowly throughout my entire life. She kind of would slowly lose her sensibilities. And by the time I got to 6th grade, she was sort of in and out of like foster homes and that sort of thing. Didn't really have any relationship with her. My earliest memories were just sort of tending to her and try to help with the family. From an early age, I felt a little bit responsible, you know, I don't know, as much as a 6th grader can feel responsible, but you know, I saw early on that my mom wasn't really all there. So that was sort of growing up. And then, you know, by the time I was in high school, she was like in sort of a more established foster care, I guess you would call it. You know, growing up like that, it was just confusing, to be honest. It was just sort of a thing that I never really, in the family, we never talked about. It was kind of just like a taboo area from my earliest memory, like even parent-teacher conferences in 4th grade. And I'm just like, no, like it would be my grandma or something that would come, you know, but it was never discussed. And in hindsight, I wish I at least addressed that somehow. But, you know, when you're in 6th grade, you don't really know what to do. So my dad, supporting 10 people, he worked like crazy. I had a lot of animosity for him growing up just because like we didn't have and still don't have a relationship. But in hindsight, in the past couple of years, I kind of see how he had a pretty hard path too. He didn't exactly know how to handle it. So he did the best he could by keeping a roof over our heads and supporting us, you know. I definitely wouldn't say it was a brutal childhood. It was honestly really fun. That was kind of the focus. The story that I love to tell the most about growing up was for a couple of years, my dad had these insane mud bogs. Are you familiar with what a mud bog is?
I mean, from the two words together, I kind of have an idea. I just imagine like a swampy space out in the yard somewhere.
Right. So we had like a decent, you know, probably like an acre or two, but my dad cut like a giant rut, probably 300 yards long, you know, pretty long, like enough where you could race two cars down it. And it was just mud, a very country sort of event, but it was truly like a town event, like over 500 people would come and, you know, the cops would try to shut it down, but it was too big. So they'd end up just like partying. It was like a band. And, you know, from an early age, I just remember like it was a full on bash. And so for a couple of years, he had those. And those were some of the best times growing up where it was just like, this is wild. This is so fun. We would go on vacations and that sort of stuff. There wasn't anything too, I guess, brutal aside from the, like not having a relationship with your parents.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was fun. I'm super close with all my brothers and sisters. You know, we're sort of a uniquely tight knit group. You know, we're kind of knit in the way that we'll do anything for each other. But as far as day to day, week to week, there's not a whole lot of hand holding. Much different than my wife's family. She has like a family of four and they talk, they see each other every week. She talks to one of her parents every day, most likely. I talk to my dad like, you know, four times a year, maybe, if that. And my mom passed away 2 years ago. So that was pretty brutal. My baby girl, Lennon, was born. And then a month later, my mom passed. So it was like, what's going on?
Yeah.
Everything sort of got turned upside down. So that's pretty much the lay of the land. Just to loop in like creativity and design and that sort of stuff. All my family is, like I said, my dad would paint cars professionally. My mom was like an oil painter. She had just sort of had an innate skill. And then all my brothers and sisters, pretty much, like one of my sisters is like a printmaker. One of my sisters is an interior designer. One's a metalsmith. My brother could draw. He can still draw like crazy, but he ended up being a psychotherapist, which is just funny. We were definitely like the artsy kids. That was our wavelength all throughout growing up. So,
wow, that's really interesting, man. Thank you for sharing. And when you said like, oh, we're really going to dive in deep, you know, I asked this question and I have no idea what the other person's going to say. I think it's really interesting that your dad did what he did for a living. It's decorative, but it's also badass. And no surprise, maybe, that so many of your siblings and yourself pursued art or creative practices of some kind. You know, at least seeing your dad provide for 10 people with that as his occupation, I'm sure that made an impression. Like, oh, this is possible. It's not like, you know, he took on a factory job in order to pull this off. He was entrepreneurial and creative. Were there other things that his occupation or maybe hobbies had an influence on your early creative pursuits?
Definitely him running his own business had a big impact on me. I've had one job, two jobs in my life, and I was like, I think I can do it on my own. I think that was really subconscious, you know? I had the confidence to do stuff. I don't know if I necessarily put A and B together that like, oh, my dad did, so I can. You know, when you're out more in the country, it's a lot of like figuring out stuff to entertain yourself and interest yourself, you know? Another correlation is like when he gets into something, he really dives in and almost becomes like a expert on it. The older he got, he moved more into motorcycles and would build these show bikes, and like he would end up making money on it. He would restore a bike and then sell it. And that sort of just approach to life of like understanding that there's ways to make money, that creativity is like a tool that you can use, definitely was a big proponent of mine. Like, I didn't really take school that seriously, honestly. I had enough book smarts to pass all my classes, and I had a healthy fear of my dad to make sure I passed, but I never really applied myself. It was like art was the only thing that I would ever apply myself at. So when high school graduation came around and everyone was like, oh, I'm going to this school and this school, I was like, wait, what? You got to figure out the next step? That's crazy. Basic synopsis was I graduated high school, applied to college. The only one that I knew of was the one that my sister went to, Grand Valley State University. Didn't get in because my GPA was like a C average, right? So I went to community college for a year to transfer in. And that was the year where I was like, wow, I definitely don't want to stay in this town. A lot of my friends that didn't go to college, they started getting factory jobs and that sort of thing. And I was just like, okay, I'm going to take this year seriously. I ended up getting a 4.0, transferred into Grand Valley, got accepted to the graphic design program, which was like super competitive. So that was sort of my launching pad year, the year after college.
You had said earlier that you struggled with the relationship that you had or didn't have with your mother, and that at times you had animosity towards your dad, and more recently were able to take on his perspective and see maybe things a little differently. How much of that new perspective and new insight into maybe what your dad was dealing with came from you yourself becoming a dad?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was all from becoming a dad. Like in middle school, high school, I was just really just angry, mostly because I didn't know what was going on, you know? It was just sort of another like thing that was in the box, right? Like that no one talked about. You know, me and my brother would talk about it. My siblings, we would all sort of talk about it, and at all different times, like we all had animosity. I think my older sister started to lighten up sooner. She also had a kid, and I think that affected her. And so when I had a kid, that's when I really started to, you just see it in a different perspective. I think honestly, it softened him a little bit. Like, you know, in these last 2 years of having a kid, we've had more conversation than we did my entire life, to be honest. Conversation of any depth. You know, he kind of had a moment. It was like one of the first days that he met her. I took a picture of the two of them and showed him. And, you know, he had to step to the bathroom because he was like, who is that old man? He had to kind of gather himself a second. So I think it was, you know, having kids and him like becoming a grandpa. It's definitely been a softening on both sides. I mean, it really just opened my eyes to be like, wow, he raised 8 kids. That's pretty wild. Yeah,
I can't imagine that. God.
Yeah, to raise 8 kids. But then also, like, we had a stepmom for years, which I was thankful to have. She was more of like the support figure. Once she came into the picture, she was at like the parent teacher stuff and more like at school and at basketball games and that sort of stuff. But I always just had animosity for my dad for never going to any of my stuff. But in hindsight, I'm like, yeah, why? He's not going to sit 3 hours at a basketball game, which he hates. you know, he absolutely hates it. So like I see it. He could work a half a day in that time, you know? So I get it now. It's definitely a maturation process on my end.
It's pretty remarkable that someone so small and unaware, like a baby, can have such profound impact on grown men, you know?
Like, it really is.
Like this little baby that doesn't know anything about anything and has no idea how influential she is softening two hardened men with decades of stuff in between them, and maybe in some small way, bringing them closer together is like, what? That's a lot of power in a little, a little
it
baby.
It really is. I mean, it's, honestly, it's like it's hard to even put into words. It's like this, the way I see it is like your brain starts to function in a different way. You know, my dad's like a biker dude and he definitely presents as like a rough kind of guy, but then when you hit that soft spot, he opens right up. And I kind of have this, you know, similar tone. I can be a little bit, but when it comes to her, I'm just like, oh, I'm ice cream on a hot summer day, you know. I can't help myself. So
yeah, it's a crazy thing. There's something chemical and psychological and emotional and all those things, but I think there's something also just, you know, something cosmic and magical that's like really hard to put into words until it's happening to you.
For sure.
So you kind of get your act together, focus on that community college year, get everything in order to make it into a pretty competitive art program. And then you mentioned you've really worked two jobs, you've said, you know, two traditional work for someone else kind of jobs before striking out on your own. Is that fair characterization?
Yeah. So went to college, met my wife, Abigail.
And did you meet her in the art program?
Yep. She actually, it was like the first semester, just drawing 101. Like Abigail and I's friendship started out as friends, like, you know, flirting friends. But yeah, we sort of courted each other for basically all of college, and then started dating later on, like at the end of college. Two of the graphic design guys, Ian and Neil, became really good friends when we started like a t-shirt company. We had like these art events. We had a couple big like fashion shows, I guess. They were a lot bigger than that. They were similar, honestly, I'm making that link to my dad's parties. I threw a couple in Grand Rapids, Michigan, that I sort of spearheaded. And then me, Neil, and Ian, we built groups of people that would put the show on together with us. I learned a lot in those 4 years. Like I learned a lot in school, but from doing our own stuff, I learned so much just with how to freelance, how to be a freelance designer and illustrator, all those nuances, like how to get clients, how to talk about money with clients, how to frame up a project, you know, all that stuff I started doing in college. And really Ian had a really good background in that. He works at Apple now. He has like a business acumen. We kind of like, we would run these businesses and like we did the website for the school and that sort of stuff all while we were in school. And then my senior year, I kind of started to come into my own. And back in those days, it was like the blogs were the big thing. I got some traction on a couple big blogs and started getting big, giant clients that I was like, I was honestly shocked. I like worked for Adidas and did a bunch of stuff for Mountain Dew and like just had these clients where, you know, I'm working out of a college dorm room and, you know, we're throwing around projects that are like $5,000+. I'm paying for all of the rent because I was like making more money than I had ever thought could. I was pretty lucky. This guy, Josh Spear, he had this group called the Spear Collective, and he taught me so much just in that it was for like 2 years. He was a pseudo agent. Like I would send over rough ideas of budgets and he was like, dude, you got to times that by 10. This is the big leagues. You know, he explained so much to me. So yeah, he just took a liking to me and sort of took me under his wings and showed me everything. And really it was just like building contacts and building like the skills to run a business and get proper money, you know, and just run the project properly. So when I got out of school, I had this solid portfolio with big clients. So like after I graduated, we kind of moved back here and I was like, okay, I'm gonna live in Chicago, I guess, and figure it out. I had money saved, but I didn't want to waste it all on rent. You know, you go from paying like $350, I want to say, for rent, which is crazy. And then you go and you look in Chicago and it's like $1,300. And I'm like, whoa, this is going to chew up my money in a year. Like there's no, I didn't make hundreds of thousands. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I was like, okay, that's not going to work. So this opportunity with OfficeMax just came about through Creative Circle.
Okay. You moved back to Chicago, you got listed with them, they placed you there, they brought the opportunity to you.
Right. It was, to be honest, I didn't exactly really know what it was. They reached out to me and were like, hey, come meet. And I was like, okay, great. Like I walked out of the meeting and they called and like, hey, would you wanna would you want to work tomorrow? And I'm like, sure. Then, you know, we go through the money and I'm like, this is way lower money than I thought. So I like negotiated a way higher rate. You could tell that they didn't want to, but I was like so willing to walk away from it. So it worked out well. They kind of came more to the middle and it was good money. Got like a nice apartment, of course, way too nice for how old we were. You know, we were just figuring it out, right? Like I was working at Office Max of all places. And it was a weird time, you know. It was like not a weird time, it was a fun time, but it was the grown-up level where you have to like pay real rent. There's no like student loan fallback money and that sort of thing, you know. I was working on Adidas freelance projects and like I had a lot of like client work coming in, but I was also doing the Office Max day job thing, mostly because that was the thing that everyone said you're supposed to do. You're supposed to get like a job when you graduate college, right? So I was like, okay, I'm going to try this. These opportunities have presented themselves. But at that time, I was like, I just had so much energy. I could do both. I was working at night, working all day. It was not like I didn't even blink. When you're young and spry, I mean, I wish I had that energy still. I would do my own stuff. Like I would make art in whatever extra time I had.
You're in Chicago. You're doing kind of this adulting thing that feels funny, but you've got an apartment. You guys are both commuting out to Office Max corporate doing design work, hustling like hell on freelance and side projects. And you've got all this energy. And so you guys are still, you're unmarried. Is that right?
Yep.
And where does Make & Co. fit into the timeline?
Even in college, like we would talk about wanting to run a design studio together, a creative studio. I would go with her back home to Chicago and, you know, the 3-hour trip both ways, we wouldn't listen to music. We wouldn't do anything but talk about this company that we were going to run and how we wanted it to be and how we could get clients. And we'd make these like business plans and just like daydreaming. And so when we got to Chicago, Abigail kind of went the agency route. She found an agency Upshot that she liked. She found a creative director there that she really liked, Bill. She's still like sort of her mentor. And that kind of kept her entertained and intrigued for 5 years. And it was really honestly just the unknown of like not having that stability. After like 2 or 3 years, I was just like, I think we should do this. And it took me 2 years to just convince her. I worked at a small agency over in Fulton Market, West Loop area, just seeing how that agency worked and how small of a team it was, how it operated. I worked there for like 6 months and I was like, all right, I know exactly how to do this. I'm working on big clients like Miller and Bubblicious at night. So I definitely feel like I can do it. So for a couple of years, I just started building clientele, building network, and really being sure to like get my name out there and just like continue the boost that I had coming out of college. So finally, I convinced her and then she quit. We got a real office and we just kind of went all in on it. It just took time. She's definitely more of a thoughtful type, but at some point we just sort of had to jump.
And so you make this leap, you're already ready for it. And she's coming around to the idea and rightfully so. I mean, you're talking about things like health insurance and all the other perceived stability that comes with working for somebody else. And I guess what gave you the confidence to go all in and bring her along? Because you could have started your own thing and she could have stayed working for a studio. Like what was it about the two of you together and what made that more sure for you?
I kind of saw that being a solo freelance designer, prospective clients definitely look at you different when you're like presented as a studio with an office. She's really good at the account side of stuff, the creative direction side of stuff, where like strategy and organizing everything versus me. I'm kind of like artsy side of it. And we both kind of saw how we could pair well together and how it kind of would be a yin and a yang thing going on. It really just took time to sort of build that confidence for her and for me to sort of show her that we could do it.
Mm-hmm. And so how far into making company and having a proper studio space and really putting some definition to this partnership with your wife creatively before you're pregnant, the two of you, and expecting your first kid.
So we registered the LLC 2011, and then she came over, I think it was right at the beginning of 2012. So 2012 to late 2017. So we had five good years. Not that we don't have good years anymore, but that was like, built out the office, built out a good sort of chunk of ongoing clients. And we really got everything set up. You know, even though I had been freelancing and doing it for years, there's still so many little nuanced things that you pick up just with like contracts and how to handle your schedule better, all that stuff. I still to this day learn little things about ways to run operations day to day. But when the little one came along, that really, it's a new way of thinking. Like, now we're balancing two jobs, the life side of stuff and then the work side of stuff. So it was a sorting out process. I mean, we kind of just like got through, you know. I don't think we managed it as well as we could have in hindsight, which, you know, totally fine. It's our first time. It was basically a juggling process.
What was it like when you actually, like, the day, you know, thinking back to the moment that you found out, what, like, can you characterize the emotions or how you felt when you learned of this fact?
Oddly enough, Abigail got it on video.
Like, got your reaction on video?
Yeah. And honestly, the first thing that went through my head was disbelief. Like, I wasn't sure if she was playing a joke. Not like, it was just like, wait, what, are you being serious? And I just kind of said, what? And then once I realized it was real, it was kind of, the best way I can describe it is, you know, when you're at the tip top of a roller coaster, right before you take the big drop, you know?
Yeah.
And your stomach is like sinking. That's exactly how it felt. Like, it was like, to me, it was like a emotional wave just washed over me. It was just like the weirdest, like, worry, fear, every emotion. I was just like, what did we do? You know, that's honestly what first came over me. It was just like, whoa, I felt sick almost, you know?
Were you planning to have kids then, or was this a surprise?
The basic timeline was, you know, we dated for years and years. You know, that whole marriage thing was just a big mental block for me. I was just so, I don't know. It was a lot of things wrapped into it. So it was like, we got married, and then, you know, you start to realize that, like, you're not going to be young forever. So she kind of just persuaded me. It was, I think, a little over a year after we got married. We had a couple of those conversations like, hey, I mean, I'm not a spring chicken. My eggs tick tock, you know. We had that conversation. And so the thing was, we tried, and like, literally on the first try, it happened. So I thought it was going to take at least a couple months.
Right.
It was like 2 weeks. Honestly, we took a couple trips just to like celebrate, and, you know, you start the process and it's kind of crazy at first. It's like you practice your whole life not doing that, you know what I mean? And then you finally do it, and that, you know, that's a whole kind of a mind fuck. Like, I was just like, what are we doing? And then it happened so quick that I was like, is she joking? Or are you playing a cruel joke on me? Are you just practicing? What's going on? And then you could tell by the way she was acting. I was like, holy cow. That was a funny time for like, we had just gotten married, did all this. And, you know, that alone was a big undertaking. So then a year later, this happened. And then, you know, we got pregnant, and we were living in the Ukrainian village, kind of just like not an apartment suitable for a baby. Let's put it that way. You know, it was a one bedroom. There was no extra room. Right. To be honest, we kind of panicked. We kind of just changed everything quickly. We bought this condo that we didn't love, got it all set up and built out to accommodate the baby. Yada, yada, yada. And it was kind of like one of those things, in hindsight, not the smartest thing to do, to buy your first property, being a designer. We're putting up all this designer wallpaper and refinishing the floors and blah, blah, blah. that was just a really chaotic period where we're closing on a place, finishing it, and then the baby's coming, and then my mom passed away. It was that whole year and a half was just like, what's going on? But, you know, it's you figure it out, you get through.
What went through your mind with regards to work? Because you're only a few years into making company and you're kind of finding your rhythm and groove there. And you've got this thing that you've convinced her to, you know, leave the security of full-time work and benefits. And now you're adding, you know, one more life to the equation. What went through your mind with regards to work?
With all that stuff, a new life, my mom passing, work did take a backseat in my mind. We had definitely established some big ongoing clients, right? So we had established three of those larger accounts for Make a Co. And, you know, we had 5 years of getting all that sort of straightened out, and it was a pretty well-oiled machine, and it still is. Like, Abigail manages that really well. We didn't really need to get new business. So I sort of pulled back on that. And then the creative side of stuff, like I said, Abigail's definitely in the like creative director role. So it was sort of just like a juggling act between us. We have a couple of freelance designers we work with. So it was sort of like a learning to delegate more. And just with life, with having a baby, it was like work is obviously important. We need to make money, but the priority for me was just like trying to manage my emotions and that sort of stuff. And then being able to like separate in my head my mom's stuff, I kind of could separate what was happening in my life and I can focus on what I'm doing at the time, you know? Mm-hmm. Although that might not be a great thing during certain times, that's like, it's a pretty useful tool. Like when, you know, painting these large murals or whatever, I can just be like, this is what I'm doing right now. I know, you know, there's all this stuff in the background, but right now I'm just going to focus on this one thing.
Yeah. I'd imagine compartmentalizing things or...
Yes, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah, putting all your attention towards something else that can act as a diversion or distraction, or just breaking up all of these things into smaller parts that feel a little bit more manageable probably becomes pretty critical to your own mental fitness and survival.
Definitely.
Yeah. So I'm curious what else shifted in terms of, you know, you've built up a creative practice, a process and approach to the work that you do. And a lot of the mural work is wholly owned, you know, that's you, that's your aesthetic. People are coming because they want the Jesse Horace style of work. And so you've got a way of working going, and now you're adapting to a kid and responsibilities and, you know, this partnership you have with your wife, not just in the business, but now in life, raising this baby. Can you speak to parts of your practice that evolved or adapted since having children? You know, like you're sort of mentioning, like, we used to do these sorts of things as ways of attracting clients or participating in the community. Like, how much of that stayed the same or didn't when Lennon was born?
In the earlier days, when the Post family was going on, they would have these events, like design art events. And we would go to those all the time. They were like close to our apartment at the time. And those sort of industry events, we would always try to at least be present in, like throughout the year, right? Like with AIGA and different types of events, like Post Family, Firebelly. There's all these great agencies that have built systems or whatever. They've built networks that would do stuff that we would try to just make sure to be a part of, like make sure to, whether it was art shows or whatever, we would make sure to make time for that. But when the little one comes, that time just goes away. Like there's so many bigger pieces that come into play. So that's one of the biggest things that has sort of like changed, that that extra time, that extracurricular is just not a space that there's time for. So that kind of changes how we've looked at attracting clients. For the first 5 years, the clients would come super, super organically. It was either mostly through referrals, but also you just, if you want to call that networking, it basically was networking, just meeting people. A lot of it would come through that. Now, that's kind of the point where we're at is like, do we actually need to promote ourselves in some sort of way, shape, or form? That's kind of a challenge we're taking on right now.
Yeah, that's interesting. All the tactics that used to work suddenly don't apply when you don't have like time to execute on them.
Right. And I think coupled with that is this whole social media thing, which, you know, 10 years ago was not a thing. Going to art events and design industry events, that was the social aspect of networking. And now a lot of it's happening with like Instagram and that sort of stuff. So that's another thing that we're sort of figuring out. Like when I talk about this, it's like I feel like an old man. And maybe it's because I am an old man, or I'm definitely closer to an old man than not. But like for me, social media is not a daily thing. I will just not post for 2 weeks. You know, it just doesn't register with me that that's a thing that you have to do. I guess I need to re-wrap my head around it because social media is very similar to like blogs. It really is just an iteration. So when I had all this extra time, I was all up on it. But now I'm racing home to try to get an hour before the baby girl is going to bed. You know, like that's my priority. That's when I'm working during the day, I'm like, okay, I got to get this done. Got to get this done. And I can push this till tomorrow because it's 5 o'clock. You know what I mean? That's what I'm thinking. When I get home, I mean, I'm sure you know how it is. You get home, you have that hour, you do bedtime and you're like, that's it.
Yeah.
That's it. If there's a good show on TV, I can maybe watch it, you know?
Yeah.
But not most likely I'm going to doze off doing that. Back in the day, I would do everything, then stay up till midnight just doing an illustration purely because I wanted to, you know?
I struggle with this, I don't know if it's like cyclical logic or how to describe it, but Javier and Amaya are, they're in school, you know, or like Javier's in Montessori and Amaya's is in daycare. And, you know, we have pretty early drop-offs before we get ourselves to work. And then thankfully both programs go pretty late. And so, you know, we have a 6 o'clock pickup at one and a 6:30 PM pickup at the other. And so there's like an enormous amount of time, I don't know, 10 hours that our kids are in someone else's care, which is a big chunk of their waking life, you know? And so there's like a very harried morning routine of getting two kids out and then ourselves out. And then, you know, we're working while they're working / playing. And then we get them and, you know, there's like this little window of time where we pick them up and we get them home. Thankfully, both of these facilities are like walking distance from our house. So that helps. But like, we get them home and we get them fed and we get them bathed and we get them ready for bed. I mean, it feels like programmed down to the minute or all hell breaks loose, right? And so it's pretty regimented. We don't really deviate much during the week from that. And then they're in bed. There's like a sigh of relief. And then Maris jumps back on the computer and starts working again, you know, because she doesn't have enough time in the day to get what she needs done. And I'm doing something similar, you know, and then somewhere in there we go to bed. And I guess I say all of that because it's Monday through Friday, we have a couple of hours in the morning and a couple of hours at night. And so in total, we're maybe getting, I don't know, 4 hours with our kids. And those are pretty decided hours. They're very routine. And they're spending 10 hours with somebody else. And I know that's just life. Like they'll be in school and doing the same thing. And so it's on one hand very normal, but then on the other hand, I'm like, we made whole humans from scratch and we're spending a total of, you know, maybe 20 hours with them during the week. And those 20 hours are, they're kind of already determined, you know, like it's dinner and brushing teeth and pajamas and, you know, like, why? What are we doing? Like, what is this? Like, you know, on one hand, yes, it's quality time. We make sure to be focused on our kids and our phones are off and we're, you know, it's good time, but it isn't much out of the day, you know, and 20 hours a week with your kid and 40 plus hours a week at work seems like a very strange ratio. It's like, and yet we're doing it, you know, like, and yet we decided to do this thing and have kids and we don't spend a lot of time with them during the week.
That's part of the reason why we wanted to run our own studio is like in the summer, this is the beauty of the winds. My wife's family. So in the summer, there's a thing called Pool Tuesday. My mother-in-law, they have a big giant pool and all the cousins, all the kids her age, they go on Tuesday and play all day at the pool. So that's a free day for us. Abigail can either go with, which, she, you know, because she's such a good manager, she can manage to have that day off in the middle of the week. We've sort of organized our whole life around being able to manage having time with her. So with the little one. So we, you know, we take a couple hours in the morning, whether we wake up at 6 or 7, and then by 9 o'clock, it's depending on what's going on in the day, we have the flexibility. If it's a light schedule, we can go in later. If I'm installing a mural like today, I go straight to the mural. I don't even go to the office. You do have to manage it. It's every day is not the same, but it allows for just more time to spend with her. That's for Abigail and I, that's just been a big thing. Like in these formative years that we want to put the emphasis on spending time with her. Obviously work is important and we want to make sure everything gets done, but the 9-to-5 schedule, if we're being honest, there's a couple hours in that day where mostly you're messing around. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
Especially in agency life. Like that was my experience. You would end up 2-3 hours a day, just like twiddling your fingers or making a meeting that you didn't need, you know?
Yeah.
So the way we've
there's a lot of waste. There's a lot of inefficiency.
Big time. And then you end up staying late and, you know, which is all good. But when the way the mental shift has gone is, when we're working, we're efficient. When we're not, it's all about the baby girl, you know?
Yeah. So how much of that, and maybe you're already talking through this or planning with Abigail, but how much of that do you think will shift with your second, you're expecting, is that right?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
How are you feeling?
Pretty good. It's like...
Better than you were when you got the news of the first one.
Way. I mean, that's the thing. And this is something that I'm kind of like putting at the forefront is that the second one, and I'm just going to say it, it was a completely different feeling. It truly was. It was like, I really don't want to say underwhelming, but it was not the same feeling at all. Like that shift didn't happen. Part of it was, you know, we bought a house in Portage Park. We're way more settled now. You know, we have extra rooms. You know what I mean? Like everything's sort of already set up.
Yeah.
So it was just a totally different feeling. Way more calm. Just like steady. The ship is a lot steadier now, you know?
Yeah.
Then when that happened, it was like a storm out of nowhere. You know what I mean? The first time.
Yeah. You weren't even in a ship. It was like you were still in a raft.
Exactly. That's exactly it. So now it's a lot different. I mean, I'm sure there's going to be, you know, even more juggling going on, but we've already done it once. We have a pretty good idea of how we can handle it again. And even more insight of like, okay, this didn't work last time. So. Like we were bringing, for a while, we were bringing the newborn to the office. Like bad idea. That did not work at all. But, you know, you try stuff and you crash and burn, but then you say, all right, that didn't work. Let's try something else.
Yeah. Tell me about Daddy Drinks.
Yeah. So Daddy Drinks, it's been going on for a while. Andy Schwegler and Ryan Sievert, they both have kids. I think it was Andy that kind of spearheaded it and said, hey, I need to go get a cocktail right now. Would you be up for it? And I was like, of course, you know, Andy, great friend. I've known him for over a decade. He's the man. And then I actually met Ryan through that. It's the closest thing to therapy that I've found, to just go, you hear about how everyone's week has gone and, you know, the challenges, and you hear the stories. At least for me, I haven't found that sort of tone with any other outlets. Like, you hang out with your friends that maybe are younger or don't have kids, and it's not a bad thing, but there's just not the same level of conversation. It's like, I don't know, someone that's gone through the same battle, you know? So Daddy Drinks has been like the therapeutic aspect of, like, we can go have a couple drinks, share, vent a little bit. You know, you talk about everything, and they're both designers. So it's like, you talk about design stuff, you talk about dad stuff. Honestly, it's super therapeutic for me.
Sounds like running your own company with your wife and business partner, there's some inherent features to that that allow for flexibility and pool Tuesdays and being more creative with how you manage time. I'm curious if there's anything else you do, specific tactical strategies for preserving and protecting creative time, like clearly bringing your 2.5-year-old and soon to arrive infant to the office doesn't sound like a good plan. Are there other things that you've experimented with or tried that you found some success in?
I think it's, at least for us, it's just a trial and error. Like you said, you try stuff, doesn't work, you crash and burn, you try something else. I mean, that's really what it is. I think part of the thing that we have that really works is that we kind of handle different sides. Like, she manages and I'm more of a task-based. That sort of play where we don't step on each other's toes that much is helpful, because we can sort of pass it back and forth depending on what the project is or like what aspect of the project is. I think that's a big thing, but we also kind of both have the base level of skills. So like, take writing an estimate. We both can do that. Making sure everybody has those skills. We're both pretty flexible. Even, for example, the mural stuff, like 2 weeks ago, we did a live drawing at this like sort of corporate event. And yeah, 8 months pregnant, she stepped up and knocked out a huge drawing in 2 hours with me. So it was like, we're both kind of Swiss Army types. In business in general, you have to be willing to sort of change and adapt. And I guess I would say in fatherhood too, like, I'm not scared to put the baby girl to bed or change her diaper or anything. Like, I'm willing to jump into any pond, you know? So, you know, you hear stories of a couple of buddies that are like, oh, I don't change the diaper. And I'm like, what? How do you not change the diaper? You know? Or they try not to. It's just like, yeah, I would get used to that quickly, you know?
Yeah.
Or it's like, I talk to my buddies that don't have babies and they're like, how do you change the diaper? And I'm like, you just change it. That's, you know, and I kind of feel like my dad saying, you just do it. But I mean, you just do. You just do it.
Yeah.
And that's it. So.
Yeah. It sounds like this idea of like shared basic skills. Like, we can both write estimates. You know, we can both run aspects of this business. And it's good, because who knows when one person's going to be down and the other person's got to step in. And then on the other side, you have these complementary specialties where, like you said, she's great at managing. She's great at lining things up. I'm great at knocking them down and executing. And that's where you don't overlap. It's actually where your two abilities kind of meet in the middle in a balance. And that the same applies for parenting, I think, is a really good insight. Yeah, you both need to be able to do the basics. Like, I feel, you know, like I'm also struck by conversations with men who, there's like a list of things like, oh no, nah, I don't do those things. One, how did you negotiate that? You know, like, what the hell? And then the other is like, I zoom way out and I say, okay, so like, you don't change your baby's diaper, or like, there's things that your wife is in charge of. And then I think, like, what happens when, like, I don't know, you've got to talk to your daughter about sex. I think it would be really important for her to hear about that topic from her mom and her dad, right? Or like, to get two perspectives on a thing. And so I would hope that as men, we would find ways to do those things that feel outside of our comfort zone, or like, feel, I don't know, awkward, or I'm not exactly sure what's what's behind it, but like, man, there's some critical things that like, I don't think you should sidestep. And no matter how hard or awkward or uncomfortable it makes you feel, like you got to figure out a way to do that, because like not doing that just seems like you're missing out on something, or like, totally.
Whether it's like, for example, doing the grocery shopping or like washing the dishes, whatever it is, it's like, hey, this needs to be done. You're going to go do the grocery shopping. I'm like, all right, let's do it. Like there's nothing off boundaries, because it's like, especially for the baby girl, I'm not kidding. 2 weeks ago, I went to the ballet. She's 2 and a half and she has ballet classes. I want to make sure to open every door for her as much as I can, or at least like present her with those opportunities, right? We're talking through schedule. Hey, what about tomorrow? It's like, bing, bang, boom. You're the only person that can take her to ballet. And I was like, if that's what I got to do, that's what I got to do. I'm over there pirouetting. I'm kicking my feet. I'm doing the alligator chop. I'm in a room full of, you know, ladies and moms, and I'm sweating. And I was in, you know, for the first 5 minutes, I was embarrassed. It wasn't my comfort zone. But the biggest thing is my baby girl's just seeing her face, just seeing her experience that is like, I'll do that every day if I need to, you know, like that's the bond I want to build with my children, you know?
Yeah. And that she sees her dad participating, you know, all in fully in a thing that maybe another dad would do. But
would I rather her miss, or would I rather bite the bullet? I would definitely bite the bullet every time, you know? And I think just really building that relationship is the priority for both my wife and I. Like, that's what we want to be sure that she knows that we're 100% on her side, you know?
Does Lennon play a role in any of your creative work or your personal work in terms of inspiration, or is she present in that?
Mostly on like Saturdays and Sundays with my coffee, we'll like sit at the table and just draw. And to me, that's a really connecting point. Like, I don't know if she's old enough to really see that yet, but that's definitely something I hope to continue. Once she gets older, I hope with 2 artsy parents, I hope she has the skills. She can work at the office if we don't shut her before then.
Yeah, I was going to ask, if your kids end up loving motorcycles or science or sports or math or just something that feels unrelated to design and art and craft and creativity, how you feel? What will you do?
Personally, I would be totally fine with that as long as they liked what they were doing and had a drive for it. To me, that's the more important part, is not, doesn't have to be design. It doesn't have to be anything creative. It's more that they have a passion for what they're doing and they can enjoy it in some way, shape, or form. Mm. That's the goal for me, is to not have a confusion about life and what they're supposed to do. That's the important part, is like them being into something and versus like a listlessness where they're just floating through life. Like if it's that, then I'm going to have a problem with that. You know what I mean?
I do. Yeah.
Are you, let me kick that question back to you. How?
Yeah. I mean, if I'm totally honest, I would be a little bummed out. Like I don't need them to be designers or illustrators, but I just think that like the saddest thing in the world is wasted talent. I see how easy it is if we don't guard against it for the machinery to smush that out of a kid, like to smush creativity out of a kid. You ask a room full of kindergarteners who can sing, and every one of them raises their hands in an instant, you know. And then you ask a room of elementary school kids and junior high kids, and by the time you ask, you know, high schoolers, like, who in this class can sing? No one raises their hands for fear that, like, they're not singing well enough to say they can sing, or they don't feel that creative freedom anymore. I mean, I just think that's so sad. And somewhere along the way, that idea that like I can sing as a preschooler goes to like, oh no, I can never sing. I'm embarrassed. I'm not a good singer. And so I think as long as there's not talent there that doesn't get realized because somewhere along the way they got in their head that like, that's not a viable career or job, or it's unsafe to pursue that passion. As long as that's not the case, then like you, I'm all for it. Like if they want to do something I don't know anything about or something highly technical or super academic and they love it, then awesome. But yeah, like I really want my son to be into video games. You know what I mean? Like I really want my daughter to love comics, you know? And if they both are like, nah, dad, that's for nerds, then I'm going to be a little sad, you know? Because I play out these scenarios where we are enjoying these things together, or where I am imparting ideas about design or ideas about pop culture or geek culture, and they're embracing that geeky side of themselves. I like that. Like I close my eyes and I can imagine watching Star Wars for the first time with my kids. I really want that to be real, but they may get to that point and be like, dad, this movie is horrible. Like the special effects are awful. Like I only watch things in VR, dad, why are we watching this? Like, you know, like that could totally be the case. So yeah, that's how I'm thinking about it.
I mean, I would say like them seeing how much you enjoy it to me would be the way that they would embrace it, versus if you were, again, not shoving it down their throat, but if you're like, hey, we have to watch this, then they're going to fight against it. You know, it's with any, no matter what it is, if you try to make them do it, they're not going to want to do it. But that's what I mean with the drawing on Saturday and Sundays. It's like she's hopefully seeing how much I like it, and then she'll kind of gravitate towards it, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's at least my approach. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think there's like telling your kids how to do things, right or wrong. And then there's just being a living example of whatever that is and letting them kind of pick up on it and want to model it in their own behavior. And I think a lot of that is just kind of spontaneous or subconscious, or just it isn't formulaic. Yeah, I agree. Do you think being a designer and illustrator makes you a better or worse dad?
That's a hard question, better or worse. But maybe kind of what we talk to is being a little bit more emotionally empathetic. I think it makes it a more fun for sure. Like I'm happy to embrace the like funny, crazy dad that'll do anything and put on a headdress and dance around in the living room, you know, like I feel like if, say, not that all lawyers are stuffy, but if I was a lawyer that was a little bit more tight to the cuff, that it might not be as fun. I might be more of a strict person by the rule person. So I would say just someone in the creative, even not even a creative profession, but a creative outlook on life tends to be a more fun environment. Kind of similar to mine, like, although my dad was sort of, you know, he was a rough and tumble guy, we still had a lot of creativity. Like that was just fully abound in my life. The creative idea was all around me. And, you know, it wasn't like forced into me or anything. It was everywhere. My dad's, the shop had big pink walls on it, right? So like we just had a creative environment. So it kind of just through osmosis seeped into me, I think. So yeah, pretty fun. That's, I guess the answer is it makes it, I don't want to say better or worse, but a more fun environment.
I like that. That feels right. Thank you so much for being on the show and for, you know, giving up 2 hours of your life to talk about fatherhood and design. I really appreciate it. I appreciate getting to know you in this new context as dads, man. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. I appreciate you having me on and listening to me gab. So I definitely think we should make that Daddy Drinks collab happen somehow.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dadwell podcast. If you were inspired by what you heard, please take a few minutes to write a review on iTunes. As a new podcast, this helps a ton and would mean a lot to me. Dadwell is on Twitter, Instagram, Medium, and all the other relevant social networks, so visit dadwell.co to find links to all of those. While you're there, you can also subscribe to the Dadwell newsletter, check out some helpful resources and books, and even cop some fresh Dadwell merchandise. Additionally, you can support this project by becoming a patron via patreon.com/dadwell.
That's patreon.com/dadwill. Thanks so much for listening. My name is Antonio Garcia, and we'll talk again soon. Cheers.